Okay, this is Michael O'Rourke with the Oregon Historical Society. I'm interviewing Warren Nunn, or not Warren Nunn,
Warren Hicks. Now don't you get me mixed up with Warren.
Interviewing Lauren Hicks. The date is April 22nd, 1988, and this is tape 5, side A. You had said when we last talked that of all of the governor's personal staff, that Travis Cross was the most unique among you, and you indicated, well, why don't you tell me what you why you say that?
Well, Travis is a unique personality, I think. He's just a little bit different. We used to talk about him and to ourselves, way I used to think about him, he's off beat. He's got a different beat. And very fine guy, real intelligent, bright, innovative, thinks up ideas faster than anybody I ever have ever known. Very positive attitude, happy, and a nice person to be around. But, and had a lot of confidence in him, very good friends. But most of the time, I wasn't sure what he was talking about. He was always a step ahead. And particularly with me, because I think I said earlier, I'm not very politically oriented. Or I'd call myself political naive, and I'm sure that both Hatfield and Cross would agree, probably. But of course, his job and his interest was the political angles and winning political battles and making Mark Hatfield look good as he should in the political arena. So he was always thinking politically, which means you've got to think of connections or how people perceive things or how they perceive each other or what attracts attention or what's different. What's unique? Something out of the ordinary. And I like things ordinary and organized, and I'm not alert to all these nuances and subtleties, whereas Travis lives on them, and he loves them, and he creates them. And so he would come up with some idea, or do you realize that so-and-so did such-and-such at the same time that somebody else was doing something different, and they're tied together? And I went, well, no, what's the connection? But he would have a connection that nobody else, let alone me, would ever have thought of. And he'd bring these ideas together and think, well, where? How'd you ever think that up? And he didn't know, but he did. And really and truly, a lot of times when he was talking to me in a friendly fashion, not trying to con me or anything, I think, well, what do you mean? Or what does he, or I think, what did he mean by that? I wouldn't really know. He was off beat. He hit things differently and he thought of things differently than most people. And he was terrific in his job. Mark couldn't have had a better man. And of course, unfortunately, if you want to get into that a little bit, I think maybe he was so good in his job and he was so well respected and liked by his peers in that field, newspaper reporters, national people, national prominence, Walter Cronkite type, and others phoned him at home from back east, and he knew them personally, and they knew him. And he got a lot of his own notoriety among the people in the business, not the general public so much. And, of course, a lot of people, and that's where I started to say unfortunately, would sometimes remark that, or assume that Mark Hatfield was where he was because Travis Cross put him there, which wasn't the case. Travis was a tremendous assistant to Mark, but Mark didn't get there through any way but his own merit, and his own hard work, and his own astuteness. But he had a very, very big helper in Travis. But a lot of people just kind of gave Travis the credit. And this also hurt Mark, and I think it affected their relationship a little bit, because Mark became afraid that people were just saying, well, you know, Travis Cross is the guy that's doing all this, and Hatfield isn't doing much. And that wasn't too good. Now, Mark understood it, and he knew what the situation was, but still, I think hearing that sort of thing occasionally did get him, get his goat a little bit, although he would joke about it himself. In fact, I remember one time he came back from one of his trips, I think he even did this more than once, came back from trips that he made without Travis, and he'd met some governor or president or vice president of the country or a Walter Cronkite type of Eric Severide or someone, and he'd say, well, hello, Governor, how's Travis? And, of course, we'd all roar and laugh. But at the same time, I think that was getting to Mark a little bit. And it might be one reason that when he went to the Senate, he left Travis here to run his Oregon office instead of taking him with him. I don't know. And I'm just guessing, and it's not a matter of history. But I think it was a little bit of a problem that Travis is just so darn sharp that Mark didn't want people to think that he couldn't have done it without Travis. But they were very close, and they had a wonderful working relationship. And that's another little story. Mark got married when he was, just before he was elected governor. And that threw a little crimp in things, because up to that time, Mark and Travis were just, they were inseparable. And in our group of the staff there, Mark and Travis were the two that were doing the most decision-making and really were the inner political circle. And then Warren, I'd say, who was next, and Freeman Holmer, and being non-political, I was probably the bottom of the totem pole as far as deciding what was really going to happen and what the strategy was going to be. And Travis and Mark were together constantly, and Travis was his main confidant, and I would say at that point, closest personal contact, personal friend. But when Mark got married and had a wife, then there was somebody in between Mark and Travis, and it wasn't as much fun as it had been. Even though we were all happy that he was married and he had a lovely wife, we all liked Antoinette very much, and it didn't bother any of the rest of us, I think, at all. But I think really underneath it did bother Travis that Mark now was getting some advice and had a new confidant that was closer to him than Travis was. And a perfectly natural thing, as everybody understood, including Travis, but still it was a little, it was disappointing to Travis. He liked it when he was right at Mark's side every minute, and that he was the first to know Mark's inner thoughts, and now he was second. And then later on, when Jerry Frank became such a close friend of Mark's, he became third even, because Mark put a lot of confidence in Jerry Frank, and as time went on, he quite often was seeking his advice rather than ours in the office, which I think was, I don't want to say Travis or was offended by it, but it hurt him a little bit that he was no longer the number one confidant, that now there was really two, Mrs. Hatfield and Jerry Frank. So he was a great, great individual. Everybody liked him. I don't know anybody that didn't like him and admire him.
Mm-hmm. So their relationship went back to college days, right, or law school?
Well, I don't know whether Travis grew up in Salem, but he was several years younger than us. Of course, I don't know, he's 4, 5, or 6, or 7 years younger than me, and he's 2 or 3 or 4 years younger than Mark. So whether Mark knew him in school before Stanford, I don't know. It seems to me I have heard that they knew each other. I didn't know him, Travis, at all. But then, as I say, a few years separate in school, if you aren't in class together, you don't know each other unless you're neighbors. But at any rate, where Mark and Travis got together was at Stanford. When Mark left law school and went to, in 1940, fall of 46, he started at university at Stanford. Travis was there, and they got together either as former acquaintances in Salem or just because they both came from Salem. And they were both interested in politics, and Mark was going to be governor, and Travis wanted to be a political advisor, and they decided down there, well, they not only they decided, but they planned the strategy of how he was going to become governor. And by the time, at least this is a story I heard from both of them, the time they came back from Stanford, the die was cast, and it was just a matter of implementing the plan, and they did it together. Mm-hmm. And of course, Travis was doing something else, which I don't know now. I probably did at the time. I forgot what his actual job was when Mark was at, in the university. But anyway, he was working on the campaigns, and they were planning it step by step through the legislature and through the Senate. But when Mark became Secretary of State, then Travis joined him on the payroll of the state, and he, from that time on, was, I would say, the number one member of the team. Warren was the executive. He was a person with a lot of state background. He'd been a public administration major in college and went right from World War II into the state government and rapidly rose through the ranks to become a deputy of, I think it was civil service, and he was in two or three other departments, and very bright, and he rose fast. And Mark had known him in high school and college, but I don't know how well. And I don't know exactly how it was he selected Warren to be his executive assistant, but he selected him as a number one person to help him with state government and governmental administrative matters. Travis was publicity, political problems. Freeman Homer was the finance man, the budget man. And I was a legal advisor. And that was the inner staff as it started. Mm-hmm. But the very beginning was Mark and Travis.
And so the, well, how did you work together as a staff? Was there real camaraderie there?
Or? Very, yeah, real camaraderie. Very, it was fun. And it was awful hard work. And as I said before, I think I wouldn't want to, I couldn't have done it a second time, second 8 years. In fact, I was wondering how I was going to get through the last two. It was just such hard work, so demanding, so time consuming. And the pressure, there was always a pressure. You never, you couldn't say a word without fear that somebody would misinterpret it, and it would be here in the paper that Hatfield staff said such and such. So it was a pressure job for many, many reasons. But it was very exciting work, and one of the reasons it was so pleasant and such an experience I enjoyed doing was because of my admiration for Mark individually and all of the staff that we worked with. And I mean every single person. I don't recall we had anybody on the inner staff that wasn't just great. And that included the secretaries and as well as these four men who were the main advisors. And plus he had Bill Newell, his driver, state policeman, was assigned to him. I don't remember now if that was just happened or if Mark selected him. He was a very religious individual, a very fine person. He was a state, just a regular state traffic patrol officer. But once he was assigned to drive the governor's car, he became a very close friend. And he was more than just a chauffeur by a long shot. But still, that was his job. He didn't get into decision-making, and he wasn't an executive, but definitely one of the important people. And then we had one or two other. Elmer Baldwin joined the staff later as administrative senior clerical type. And we had one or two people. Conrad Joyner was with us for a while as sort of an intern. And Eric Lindauer has several people like that come and go. But they all were wonderful to work with. They all were devoted to Hatfield. They were all forthright and, you know, an honest, pleasant bunch of people to work with. And that's one of the laughs, too, we used to have among ourselves, the men on the staff, is Mark had two or three top women secretaries who were did his personal work and had been with him for quite a while. Lois Sigmund was with him in the legislature and his personal secretary. And Leona Barnett, who was sort of the head woman in the office, had been with other previous governors before she went with Mark when he was Secretary of State. And they really attached themselves to him and were super loyal to him. And as a lot of women do, they became very jealous of their position of importance to Mark and the status of their position. And we men used to smile among ourselves that the governor did a great job of, he settled strikes and he calmed down all kinds of political battles and he solved problems every day. But the one problem he never solved was how to keep the women completely satisfied and calm in his office. And the way this problem would arise would be as time went on and we got more and more work and the job grew, some of these ladies just had more to do than they could do in 10 or 12 hours a day. The work was piling up. So we were constantly reorganizing the office to shift burdens around so that the work could be spread out better and maybe hire a new girl down the line and shift some duties to her so that the more important jobs could be handled by the top women. But one thing we found was that you don't take work away from a lady who has a job like that. Every time he took some job from one of the women, they would say, or particularly these two or three top ones, they said, "Well, Governor, aren't you satisfied with the way I'm doing it? I'm just trying to do my best for you." And I think a time or two we had tears and, oh, real kind of calamities. And several times he had a big meeting in his office and called in all the ladies and tried to explain what he was trying to do and why he was reorganizing and why he took some jobs away from one and gave to somebody else. Never helped. They were so fond of him and they were so ensconced in their own jobs, they just didn't want to give up a thing. And that doesn't mean there was animosity among them, because there wasn't. It wasn't that, but it was just in the sake of efficiency, when he would try to improve things, he couldn't do it because the women just, they wouldn't give in to that. And we used to say, we solved everything that came to us, but we never solved that one. How to keep them really happy and keep away the tears occasionally. But they were tears of devotion. They couldn't have been more loyal. Of course, he knew that. And Leon Barnett went with him to Washington, in fact, and was with him in the Senate until she retired. And she was there quite a few years. Lois Sigma stayed here because her family and her husband was here. Mm-hmm. And they were wonderful people. And my secretary was Alice Sokolowski. I had one secretary, and I had her the whole time I was there. And she and I ran the legal department, and she was just a superb lady. She died of leukemia just a few years after. Well, no, it was Hodgkin's disease, just a year or so after I left the office. In fact, she knew she had it when I was still there, and she knew her time was limited, but very, very fine lady and just wonderful. They all were. Mm-hmm. I think our staff was very harmonious, and I think we had a very good staff. And I think we were recognized as being a good staff. All of his staff, from the top people down to the secretaries, had a reputation around the building of being a pretty good staff. And I was very proud of the work we did and the reputation we had. High level, a very honest group of people. Things weren't swept under the rug, because that isn't the way Mark did it. It wasn't the way any of us wanted to do it, and just wasn't done. And that's the reason he got so angry when somebody accused him of doing that. And me too. People call me sometimes on the phone and harangue me for some letter I'd written or something I'd done or said, and in all honesty and forthrightness, and then they would accuse you of having ulterior motives or things of that type. And it used to, I'd grind my teeth. But what could you say? Because you couldn't, I was speaking for the governor. And you couldn't tell him to drop dead like you really wanted to, because that might get back and reflect on the governor. It's one thing, I finally became a judge. I didn't realize it so much until I was appointed a judge and left the office. And it was just like setting down a heavy load, because I could suddenly speak for myself. I didn't have to worry that everything I said would be attributed to the governor. And you can't imagine what a relief that was. Really, it was just, I could almost stand up straight. Gosh, I'm free. I can, if I say something wrong, there's nobody's going to hurt but me. How wonderful. Because that's when you're in that job, if you take it seriously, as we all did, you've got to watch every word. Mm-hmm. Even downtown, if I was talking to somebody in the street corner about something at the office, some like Warren and I were walking along the street, I'd look to see who was standing next to me, just to be sure we could talk in confidence. And that was always with you.
Sure.
You go down to the coffee shop and you were worried about who sat down with you, because if somebody sat there, you couldn't talk about things you wanted to talk about. And you were constantly, had eyes in the back of your head, afraid that you would make a mistake or say something that would be misinterpreted. Or we weren't saying things that shouldn't be heard, but we were saying things that could weren't yet to be released, or if they were heard, they might be misinterpreted. And sometimes things were misinterpreted. And once it hits the newspapers, and it says you said such and such, even though that isn't what you said, not much you can do about
right,
it. And I see a lot of these accusations now, mainly coming out of the Washington, D.C., as you hear so much more, because it's 10 times the same thing as the governor's office, only 10 times worse from the president's office. All these accusations, I just wonder how many of them are true, because I know that so many are made when they aren't true, and that isn't what happened. But when it's in the paper, people tend to believe it. Well, it's in the paper.
Right.
It's written. Right. It must be right.
You mentioned that you thought that Mark Hatfield's marriage caused strain between the relationship between him and Travis. What were the signs of that?
Well, the only signs were just, I can't remember if Travis ever actually saying anything, but I just got the feeling that his feelings were hurt when Mark would talk to Antoinette about something instead of Travis, or that Travis couldn't spend every evening with Hatfield as they'd done in the past. Mark wanted to spend some time with his wife. And Travis didn't have time for that. He had things to do and things to talk about. And Mark would say, well, he's going to want to go home and have dinner with Antoinette. Didn't fit the schedule. And it wasn't an open strain or no words, but that's an impression that I had, that Travis frustrated him a little bit, and he felt a little bit hurt that there was someone else in there. He didn't object to it, didn't think Mark shouldn't have gotten married, anything like that, but still. Yeah. And of course, sometimes, now this is when it would kind of come out, and I don't think of any examples, but it happened quite often that Antoinette would tell Mark he should do such and such about whatever was going on. And Hatfield, Travis had told Mark, well, he should do something else. And maybe Mark would take Antoinette's advice instead of Travis's. Well, that kind of showed that bothered Travis. He gave him the good advice, and he wanted Mark to take his advice. And it bothered him that Mark wasn't coming to him all the time. And not that he thought he should, because naturally, once he's married, well, things change. But still, it kind of bothered Travis and hurt him a little bit that there was someone else who was closer to Mark than he was.
So do you remember any specific examples of issues that maybe Antoinette gave advice on that was counter to Travis's?
I can't. I just know what happened. I can remember the kind of the reaction or the fact that happened. But or we talked about in the office that looked like sometimes Antoinette and Travis would have different ideas about something, and Mark would kind of tend to go along with his wife. And it might have been perfectly natural. I can't recall now any incident, any question that came up that happened in. I just remember that it did, and we all we were aware of it, and we kind of smiled about it and kind of felt sorry for Travis, but certainly didn't think any the less of Mark Hatfield or Antoinette, because they had their ideas too. It was just, you observe how close and how devoted Travis Cross was to Mark Hatfield. And in Travis's view, just nothing should be anything in between them. Of course, Travis had a wife and children, and he spent time with them, but it's kind of hard to explain, and I certainly don't want to say there was any real problem about it, but it did exist. And I mean, I got into mainly just to illustrate how close they were and how important they were to each other and how important Travis was in Mark's career and how important he wanted to be. And of course, I think as I was alluding to, Mark then began to think maybe Travis was too important. And for his own ego, Mark wanted to make sure that people knew and that he knew that Travis hadn't done it all by himself, that Mark had a lot to do with his success. And he did. He had an awful lot to do with it. But no doubt about it, Travis was a big, big help. And he had a lot of national recognition. And I think actually, I don't know, he went with Romney for a while after Mark became a senator. I don't know if that was his only political assignment or not. I think maybe it was, but he was on Romney's staff for either quite a few months or a year or so. And I really think he could have gone a lot further in that profession had he left Salem or gone where the headquarters are in the big states. And why he didn't do that, I don't know. He just, he's a small town boy, really, in a way, even though he was such a genius in his field. He still was kind of an Oregonian, and he didn't try to throw his weight around. He never wanted to, I guess, be a big shot on the TV or newspaper. All he wanted to do was promote Mark Hatfield. And small town Salem was more his style. Although he did go to California, he worked for a nursing home company that owned nursing homes and hospitals. He worked for them for a while as their public relations, and then he worked for the, I think, St. Vincent's Hospital in Portland. But I don't think he ever reached his potential after Mark Hatfield's career. He could have done a lot more. He had the ability to do a lot more than he did. Whether that severing relations with Hatfield kind of took it out of him, I don't know. Although they're still real close friends, and he appears at all of the reunion things. But it was an interesting little personality study there.
So you mentioned that when Mark went to the Senate, that he left Travis behind in his Oregon office. Mm-hmm. But I take it that didn't last then, or?
I don't remember how long Travis did that. But of course, that would be a pretty big come down. I remember thinking at the time, gosh, if Travis had been the number one person, and then to be 3,000 miles removed and running the local office, it's a nice job for somebody. I could have done that very nicely, maybe, that wasn't what I wanted to do, but I mean, that was more my type of a thing. But Travis, his role had to be right at the heart of things, and the local office wasn't. And I don't know, as far as I know, Mark Hatfield never explained to any of us exactly why he made that decision, and I don't know if he ever explained it to Travis. I just always assumed that part of it was he just felt he had to prove that he could do it without Travis. And I'm just guessing, I don't know. I don't want to say something that is wrong, but that was my impression at the time. Okay. And it wasn't discussed much, but I'm just sure Travis was that was Mark Hatfield's decision and not a mutual decision. And I think that Travis felt badly about it. And maybe Mark did too. But I think he felt it was the right thing to do, and maybe it was. I don't know. I mean, it's better to start with a new staff.
Well,